Hey, I'm Darrell Miller, and I grew up in the southeast part of this county in an area called Fellsburg. And both sides of my family, my mother's side and my father's side, were all involved in agriculture. And they're all a bunch of hard-headed Irishmen. And here's what you figure out. They immigrated to the United States sometime in the 1860s and eventually moved out to Ohio or Illinois and then down into Edwards County. So I've got a long line of agriculture people behind me. And I know you've had some talks about the Dirty 30s, and that's the time I was born, 1936. In the Spearville Hospital. And not long ago, somebody said, Spearville has never had a hospital. I said, well, my sister and I must have been born in the back seat of a car over there, because they did have a hospital. So it's fun to be here today with you, and we'll try to talk about the 1950s. There were some big changes in agriculture. Some of the biggest advances were the tractors were going from being steel lug tractors to rubber tired tractors, and also the harvesting equipment was changing over from pull type combines to self-propelled combines, and that happened primarily in the early 50s. And after the war in the late 40s, they were starting to make some of these innovations. Also, hydraulic power was coming about, which was a big advantage because you could raise an implement out of the ground with hydraulic power rather than getting off the implement and having to use levers to pull it out of the ground, no matter what it was. So that's just a few of the things I can think about right off the top of my head, but I've got a long list we can go through here. One of my earliest memories was of World War II, because we had all these military bases around teaching young guys to fly, one in Dodge City, one in Great Bend, one in Pratt, one in Liberal, one up by Hayes. And they chose this country because of the wind, partially, and because it was flat and they could build good airports. So I remember going to the dedication of the Pratt Army Airfield when it was started, and I can't remember the exact year, but World War II basically started in 1942. But I can remember coming to town here on weekends, and the soldiers over at Dodge would get so tired of walking the streets over there, they'd hitch a ride and come over here and walk around for a change. What happened with World War II was a lot of young guys went off to the service. And a lot of these young guys were farmers. And some of them didn't return to this part of Kansas due to war injuries. And a lot of them didn't come back because they didn't want to come back. They saw things that they'd never seen before. And if you grew up on a farm, it can be pretty boring sometimes. So what we had there was a reduction in the labor force. Young guys weren't coming back to the farm. The population of the United States at the time of World War II started was 139 million. In 2013, the last census, the population was 316 million. Well, that's almost 2.25 times of an increase. So that meant something had to change in farming if we were going to keep up production to feed the people even in the United States, let alone exporting grains to some other area. So what I say is that farming changed in the 1950s from being a labor-intensive type of business to a capital type of business, meaning it took more money to operate your farm because you bought bigger equipment. Expenses were increasing up after the war. And if farmers were going to farm at the scale that they had to farm in order to make a living, they're going to be buying more land. And we're kind of seeing that same thing happen right now. The last 2 years, grain prices have been going up. They're staying good. We've seen a huge influx in the price of farm real estate. At the age I am, 78, I've witnessed this before, and I don't expect it to last. there comes a time when grain prices are going to slide down, since we're living in a world market now. But back in the 50s, it wasn't that way so much. If you had an increase of 1 or 2 pennies a day in a grain market, that was a major shift. So we've got a whole different type of atmosphere in 1950 than we do right today. We get to talking about the larger machinery and more powerful tractors that you farm more acres, self-pile combines with a higher capacity for grain, harvest more acres in a day. Started out using pull combines when I was a kid. You know, if we got 80 acres a day cut with two machines, we thought we'd really done a lot. Today, I have one of these big combines and cut 80 acres in a matter of a few hours. So we can see some big changes in mechanical equipment. Another thing that happened was more off-farm storage was being built all the time. And that's the concrete elevators you see downtown here in Offerly, going to Dodge or anywhere. The majority of those were built in the late 40s and the early 50s to accommodate the amount of grain that was coming in. And also, it helped the farmers out because they didn't have to store it on the farm. And then later what happened is they started using what they called the unit train, which they have over at Wright. They load out, I don't know how many boxcars it takes to make a unit train. Well, what happens is all of this stuff is shipped direct to the Gulf by train. It used to be it would go out of here on train and maybe go to Hutchinson to a terminal elevator. And then from the terminal elevator, it might be shipped to St. Louis and go down the river to the New Orleans ports on a barge. Or sometimes it could be taken to Catoosa, Oklahoma, which is right outside of Tulsa, and shipped on a barge down the Arkansas River and end up in the Houston area. Another thing that happened, maybe Marty talked about this a little bit. In the mid-50s, we started having commercial fertilizer. The old-time way was you cleaned out the barn and you spread it on the field. Well, it took a lot of barns to get much out there on the field. So the advent of commercial fertilizer came in during the 1950s. That's the earliest recollection I have of it. Well, you could go out and you could spread a lot of fertilizer on in a few hours in a field. Well, that's increased production greatly. And that also created a problem, as we found out in later years, because a lot of this fertilizer was based off petroleum products. This big plant you see when you go into Dodge City, Koch Industries over there, they're turning natural gas into anhydrous ammonia. So that means that they're pulling a natural gas supply down for this consumer somewhere else. At the same time, it's driving the price up. When I first started putting on anhydrous ammonia in the 70s, realizing we're talking about the 50s, it was costing me $75 a ton. Right now, it's over $600 a ton. In about 1953, the first irrigation systems that I can remember were starting to come into this county, and they were what we call a hand move system. You had the pump, the engine, and the pipe, and the pipe had the sprinkler heads sitting up on top of them, but they had to be manually carried, picked up, moved, and reconnected, picked up, moved, and reconnected. Well, this was a bunch of fun because your boots always pulled off in that mud every time you moved them. So the cost of an irrigation system in 53 of that style was around $20,000. And I wouldn't even venture to guess what one costs today. Probably getting close to $100,000 by the time you drill the well and bought the system and put it up. And also in the 50s, there was a moved by the soil conservation system for farmers to start using more environmentally sensitive practices. Anytime you turn dirt over, it aerates it. When you aerate it, it dries it out. Well, most of our tillage tools up to that time with a type of equipment that turned dirt over, so it was drying the soil out. At the same time, we were killing the weeds to hold the moisture. We were losing moisture by turning it over. Well, the Canadians were a little smarter than us, and they invented what they called the noble plow. I'm sure Brett knows what that is. Okay, the noble plow was a V-shaped instrument, tillage tool like this. And there might be two together, or there could be as many as eight or nine later on. But what it did, it ran under the ground, left the stubble on top of the ground, and cut the weeds off at the same time. Well, by leaving the stubble on top of the ground, you had what's called a mulch. So whenever it rained, then the rain goes down through the straw, stays into the ground, and it holds the moisture, held the moisture much more efficiently. But with that came more problems. With a clean tillage that we'd used with one-way plows, we were able to keep a lot of weeds down that we couldn't keep down with an oval blade. Things like crabgrass, downy broom, or as we call it, cheatgrass. So every implement I think that's ever been invented has always had a drawback to it. My dad always said the best machinery ever made was something that some farmer figured out, not something that some implement company figured out. I started farming for myself, I think I was 16 years old, and my grandfather let me rent 240 acres. Well, of course, I didn't have any equipment, so that meant that I worked for my dad for basically free for the use of his equipment to farm the ground that I had rented. And I had to pay for my own fuel and my own seed. So that's the way I started farming. And I think I had my first wheat crop in 53 or 54. And you go back and look at the statistics and the yields that we had from a program earlier at the library, and the yields on wheat in 1954 were 17 and a half bushel. And I can remember during that time period, if you raised a 20 bushel crop, you had really done a lot. You had almost a bin buster. And it was bringing prices anywhere from $2.13 down to $1.78. The acres decreased as the yields went up due to the switch to over to feed grains by some farmers. And today, in this part of the country, we probably have more grain acres in feed grains than we do in wheat due to the fact that the commercial cattle feed yards use so much corn and milo. But there's still a lot of wheat acres because not everybody has water. As we know, as we go north of town, there's very little water for irrigation. South of the river, there used to be an abundant amount of water, but that's declining every day. Around Lewis, there's a lot of wells that are only putting out about 1,000 gallons a minute. When we first started drilling wells in our area, they were pumping 2,000 gallons a minute. I never did irrigate myself. I just stayed with dry land farming. For me, I figured it was easier. What we ran into starting about 1954 was it stopped raining on a regular basis. It seemed like when I was a kid, we'd have a rain, and we'd always get 1-2 inches of rain, but and it started about 54 on it, you started shutting down the rain. In this part of the country and from here on west. So that meant if we didn't get rain, we were going to not have much of a crop the next year. And the driest year I can ever remember was 1956. And that includes the past few years that we had a drought. In 1956, my dad planted 80 acres of wheat out of all the land that he was farming at that time, which would have been probably 600-700 acres. So that meant he had probably 350 or 400 in production due to the summer fallow practices. Well, we had a pretty good sized herd of production cows, and we had them on pasture. Since it quit raining, the grass just shriveled up, died, and turned brown. So that meant we had to sell all of the cattle. At that time, Kinsley had a little sale barn right down here on the railroad track. So we sold all of the cattle because there wasn't going to be enough rain to raise any feed, feed them through the winter and get them into the next year. And this perpetuated on into 1957. Well, after the dry weather in 54, 55, 56, the government started what they called the soil bank program. And that allowed the farmer to take the land out of production. In turn, he received a payment, but he had to also at the same time plant the land back to some type of a grass to hold the topsoil so it wouldn't blow. We have the same program today, only it's called the Conservation Reserve Program. Well, as a result of this program in the 50s, there was so much land that went in to the soil bank program that we had another migration of people away from the farm. People left and they took up some other occupation. Some of them didn't come back. Some of them did. I broke some of that soil bank grass out in 1976. This meant it had been in there 20 years. My dad said, it won't be 5 years till you wish you'd never done that, because it's going to go back to being the same type of soil. Fertilization will be gone, and the problem of the ground blowing will be back. Well, he was wrong. It only took 2.5 years. So he was wiser than I thought he was. There's something about parents being wiser than you think they are. Don't ever forget that.
Do you think you and your family were well prepared for this drought in the 50s and in the 30s?
I don't think anybody's ever well prepared for a drought. You know, there's always farmers that are always the optimists. You know, it's going to rain. They call it the next year country out here. Well, the farmer always thinks, oh yeah, the price will be better next year, and the rain will be better next year, and we'll do a better job of farming next year. But I think probably in this day and age, since we've gone to doing a lot of chemical tillage and conserving moisture better, that we can get along better than we did back in that time. That's a good question. Tell your dad to sell his grain when it's up, not when it's down.
I think he's aware of that.
Oh yeah, every farmer is aware of that. You never sell on the up market, you always sell on the down market. I mean, that's a smart thing to do. And that's another thing that's come evolved. Farmers are more aware of how to market than they used to be, you know. They're more aware of their input costs. They're more aware of what they've got to have to make everything work. And that's part of the thing that Kansas State University's done, plus the Department of Agriculture. They share some wit in that also.
Did you go to school when you were younger?
I went to this school. I graduated here in 1954. I started out in a little country school in the first grade at Fellsburg. I went first grade, second grade. Well, they'd already closed the high school down because there's so few students. Well, they closed the Fellsburg school down. And they sent part of us to Centerview, which is 5 miles west. And part of them went to Truesdale and a few went to Lewis. So I went to Centerview my third, fourth, fifth grade. And then at the high school folded there. So they split us again, and I went 5 miles east from where my folks live to Truesdale School. So I started in sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, freshman, sophomore, junior, and then I came here my senior year. And one reason I came here is I had 2 sets of grandparents that lived here in town, so I had somewhere to bunk. And I wanted to take some courses that I really couldn't get at a small school in Truesdale. But there were a lot of kids that went out of that school that did very well. Some of them became doctors. So not necessarily the size of the school. It's what goes in up here and stays. I'll answer your question a little further. In 1956, I decided, since things weren't working too well, maybe that I should go to college and get an education. When I graduated from high school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I had a couple of small scholarships, one to Emporia State and one to Hayes, I think it was. One was music, the other was journalism. So this little blonde came to school here in about 1955. She really caught my attention. And anyway, we ended up getting married in 1957 and left here and moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and that's where I went to college. Had a four-year degree in radio and television broadcasting. And that got me a dollar an hour job when I graduated. But I'd made more than that driving a tractor, so I think maybe I went backwards, I'm not sure. Anybody else got a question?
How much of the community were farmers?
Okay, I'm having trouble hearing you, I'm sorry.
How much of the community were farmers?
How much of our community? Oh, about 100%. Yeah.
How close were the farms before?
Oh, you know, at one time I think there was a farmstead on every quarter section. You know, because as I'd work the land, I'd see broken glass and things in different places. And I'd ask my mother or my grandparents, you know, I'd say, you know, what was out there? Well, there was a house there. Somebody lived there once. Well, you can go out there today and still find the same thing. So, but it was a great American dream to come west and own a piece of land and become a farmer. Well, it kept taking more acres, more acres, more acres. And when I started farming the second time, I farmed all the land that was owned by my dad, all the land that was owned by my grandfather, all the land that was owned by my wife's father, and a whole bunch more. At one time I had like 14 landlords. Some of them I never saw the whole time I farmed. So we had 3,000 acres that was scattered from Belfry. They're down to south here on the county line. Well, I found out that I could only handle so much, so we started cutting back, and it worked better. But we figured out how much we had to do a day to get where we wanted to be by the next day, and that's what we geared up to do. So a little simple mathematical formula is speed times the width of the implement you're pulling gives you the acres an hour that you can work. So back in the 50s, if we had a tractor that would go 4 miles an hour and we're pulling an implement that took a 10-foot cut, take 4 times 10, and what do you get? 40. Divide that by 10 and you get 4. So you get 4 acres an hour. Okay, we go up to 45 foot. Well, let's say 40 foot, that's easier. And we're pulling that implement at 5 miles an hour. So 5 times 40 is what? I think it's 20 plus. So it figures out, dividing by 10, we're getting 20 acres an hour. So we figured on doing at least 160 acres a day. And we never started the field in the afternoon that we couldn't get finished before night. Because if it rained that night, we just lost part of that day. And it was the same in the 1950s as it is today. So you could figure the same thing on combining wheat. If your wheat platform was 12 foot, your tractor is moving 3 miles an hour, depending on how heavy the wheat was, you can figure about how many acres a day you should be able to harvest. But what happens at harvest time? Combines break down, trucks break down, things happen. They don't always go the way you want them to.
In comparison, Do we have more or less farmers today and present day than we did in the 50s?
Way lot less. Yeah. One of the reasons is just what I was talking about. The equipment has gotten so much bigger that one person can do the work of what two were doing, or three sometimes. And so there's been a constant migration of people away from the farm. I mean, my son is a good example. He has an engineering degree, a master's in engineering, and he'd love to be farming, but I didn't want him to go through what I've been through, you know, because it was a constant struggle to try to keep up, keep the money moving, keep the money borrowed that I had to have to operate. And so a lot of young guys got discouraged from wanting to farm simply for the reason that they had seen what their parents were doing and knowing how much land it took to try to keep an operation in a size that it would have to be to make a living for them and their family. And that's why still today you see a lot of moms working off the farm and a lot of dads have got second jobs, you know. But somewhere inside of them they want a farm, and that's what they're going to do as long as possible. Good question.
What type of stories did your family tell you about the Dust Bowl?
Well, as if you've seen the exhibits over there at the library, you realize what it was like. But the first thing that I can remember my mother told me was that it was so hot, and she put me out on the back porch, the little porch on the side of the house, in my crib. And in the night, the wind came up and the dirt started blowing. And she thought, oh, I better check on my son. And she went out and she said, I was so black she couldn't tell me from the cover on the bed it was supposed to be there. So I was totally covered in dust. That's one that I can remember. But most of the things were due to the drought. I mean, one thing that made the Dust Bowl so bad was that we had the financial depression, stock market crash. All of this happened at one time. Well, my mother and my dad got married in 1929. And at that time, you could go 2 years to school and get an emergency teaching certificate, which she did. And she started teaching in the one-room schoolhouse that she had gone to as a child herself. And she had one student the first year. Well, then they closed that school down and she moved into a little bit bigger one. And I told this story the other day. One time I came in with my tractor, nice air-conditioned tractor, and I thought, I'll park it at the fuel barrel and I'll go up to the house and see my mom. So I went up to see her and she said, how's it going today, son? And I said, well, not really the way I planned it. This happened and that happened, something else happened. It just wasn't a very good day. And she said, well, let me tell you a little story. Your dad and I got married in 1929. The stock market crashed. We lost our first child. The wheat got hailed out. And our house burned down. Have you got anything else you wanted to complain about? I said, no, Mom, I don't think so. So that's one of the stories I remember. But I know my grandmother told me once the dirt was blowing so bad in the daytime that they ran it. Somewhere they gathered up all this rope and they had rope running from the backyard fence out to the barn, which wasn't so far. They had a few cattle they had to take care of. And they take hold of that rope and they guide them to the barn, and when they got the barn, well, they were feeding the barn to take care of the cattle. But yeah, it was an awful experience. I don't think my dad ever got over it. Everything he did from then on mentally was connected back to that Dust Bowl time, and that time of not having any money, the time of being afraid to being in debt, time of seeing people lose their farms. he told me he bought a piece of ground, probably $20 or $30. He said I could raise enough on it to pay the interest on the note, which is probably like 2.5 or 3% right then. So it stayed with him his whole life. And when I was farming, you know, he watched everything that I did, and he'd say, "Are you sure you need to buy that tractor? Or why did you buy that tractor?" Well, I said, "I bought it because I needed it." Well, he also told me, he said, "Do what you can do by yourself and don't hire any help because they'll drive you nuts." So one day he comes up and he says, "How do you think you're going to farm all this land you're farming with no help?" And I said, "I've got help." He said, "Well, who is it?" I said, "My wife and my son." Well, I'd never made it without my wife. She drove a tractor on all hours. And my son did all the time, too. Until he was in about sophomore in high school, and his grandfather got cancer. So I let him go work for him, and he worked 2 summers for him before he died. But like I said, yet right today, he'd probably just as soon be farming as living in San Diego, California, selling insurance. It's in his gene pool, I guess. Another good question. Well, this is something I should have mentioned. That when we graduated from high school in 54, I mean, we just got over the Korean, or I mean, we got over the World War II, we got into the Korean War, we were fighting the Cold War. And so they still had the military draft going on. You didn't have any choice. I saw my collective service card the other day. So a whole bunch of guys in my class, they either volunteered and joined up, or you knew you were going to get drafted. Well, I didn't volunteer, and one of the things that happened was Kiowa, Comanche, and Edwards County had a 3-county draft board. Well, there are a lot of conscientious objectors in Kiowa and Comanche County. Well, they weren't taking those guys because they said, "No, we don't want to carry a gun and go to war." So finally, the guy who was our county representative got wind of it, and he said, "That's not right." So they had him go over to Larned and work at the state hospital, and they quit pulling so many guys out of this area. But I'd never made it because I couldn't pass the physical for ROTC when I went to college.